Welcome, day three of the conference. I hope you had a good sleep after yesterday's Czech dinner. So back to this dinner, I hope you enjoyed it and you enjoyed the music there. So I won't read all the names and all the links to web pages, but in case you want to have these brave guys and girls invited to your garden party, there will be links on the conference webpage. And I was especially amazed by this hardcore jazz band that was playing in one of the rooms. That was really excellent. People from ordinary secondary school, not even music secondary school. So again, you can visit their website or just type hardcore Prague into Google and you will get it. There is one. Next slide, please. Oh yes. Okay, so one practical remark about restaurants. We had some complaints, like too few in the plan, queues, short queues, long queues, not the type of food I want. So the solution is to ask Renata at the information desk, and she will be happy to advise you any restaurant in the vicinity of this place or in the center. Now, this is all for the practical info, and we'll have an invitation to ESPA conference done by Panos Papamichalis from SMU, Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. This morning I would like to introduce to you the 2012 International Conference on Emerging Signal Processing Applications, or ISPA 2012. My name is Panos Papamichalis, and I am the General Chair of ISPA 2012. ISPA 2012 is not a workshop. It is a full conference organized by the Signal Processing Society. It is expected to be the third major conference of the Society, together with ICASP and ISIP. But it has a twist. It is addressed primarily to practicing engineers. Of course, everybody is welcome, both as contributors and participants. Something else that makes ISPA different from ICASP and ISIP is that it will be held every year at the same place and time. It has been planned to overlap with the Consumer Electronics Show, so it is held in Las Vegas in early January. When we say practicing engineers, my definition is someone who has a master's degree in general signal processing. As a result, the presentations are expected to be applications-oriented and not contain esoteric theories. To facilitate participation from industry, ISPA will also include presentations without a paper. Of course, papers can be submitted too, and these papers will be archived in the IEEE Explorer. But their content is not expected to be deep theoretical. Another major component of the conference is the demonstrations, what we call show and tell here at ICASP. And in addition, we will have tutorials, plenary presentations, and panel discussions. You can find more information in the call for papers that we have at the information booths here at ICASP, or please come and see me. So you are all invited to submit papers for ISPA 2012. One more thing. The conference has not adopted a logo yet. We encourage you to submit your ideas for a logo, and there will be a 300 award for the logo chosen. So I hope to see you all next January in Las Vegas. It will be fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Panos. And it's time to start today's plenary. Our speaker will be Philip Chao, and my colleague Jonathan Chambers, Technical Program Chair, will introduce our speaker. Jonathan, please.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to begin by repeating what Honza said, and for those of you who attended the Czech evening yesterday evening, it was in a very special location, and the music was a very special experience. So thank you very much to the local organizers for organizing that. It's my great pleasure to introduce Philip Chow this morning. Just a very quick look at his CV or bio will show you that it's a sort of veritable who's who of some of the leading academic and industrial units in the US. He received his degrees in the 1980s from Princeton, Berkeley, and Stanford. Following that, he worked at AT&T Bell Labs, Murray Hill, New Jersey, Xerox Palo Alto Research Center in California, and since 1998, he's worked at the Microsoft Research Center in Redmond, Washington, US, where he heads the Communications and Collaborative Systems Research Group. Philip has been a real servant for the IEEE Signal Processing Society. Most recently, he chairs the Multimedia Technical Committee, and he also serves on the Signal Processing Society Fellows Committee. He's distinguished as a co-recipient of our society's Paper Award in 1993, and more recently in 2007, he received the Best Paper Award from the IEEE Transactions on Multimedia. So thank you again to Philip for agreeing to make this presentation. I, and I'm sure the whole audience, is looking forward to his tour of immersive communications. Philip.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you very much for the introduction. It's a great honor to be on this stage, especially with Fred Jelinek over here. He was an inspiration to me early in the career. And thanks all of you for coming to the plenary at 8 a.m. after the banquet. I don't think I've ever been to an 8 a.m. plenary right after the banquet, so this is a new experience for me. I'm kind of looking forward to seeing what these plenaries are actually like. So I'll be talking about immersive communication. There won't be any equations in my slides. I know signal processing people sometimes don't really understand things unless there's math behind it, so I'll give you some references. Signal Processing Magazine had a special issue in immersive communication that came out in January. You can look at that. And just last week, a bunch of us submitted a paper to the IEEE Proceedings as part of their 100th anniversary. Both of these are on immersive communication. So the second paper here defines immersive communication to be exchanging natural social signals with remote people as in a face-to-face meeting in a way that suspends disbelief in being there. This is not a new idea by any means. The telephone was invented 135 years ago, and that was the first great breakthrough in immersive communication. And it wasn't long after the telephone was invented. Here's a cartoon that came out 3 years later, that people were starting to look at much more immersive scenarios. So this is by Georges Dumouriez. The caption at the bottom reads something like, as these parents are here in London, watching their daughter in Ceylon play badminton, and the father says, "Beatrice, come over here, I want to whisper." And she comes over and he says, "Yes, Papa dear." He says, who is that charming lady playing by Charlie's side?" And she says, "Oh, she's just come over from London. I'll introduce you after the game." So we don't really have this kind of immersive communication system even today, but perhaps something that comes fairly close are telepresence systems. Telepresence, as defined by the industry conference newsletter Wayne House Review, is a video conferencing experience that creates the illusion that the remote participants are in the same room with you. So probably the quickest way to get a sense of what that means today is to take a look at a 30-second Cisco commercial.
so.
Welcome to a network where body language is business language. Cisco, welcome to the human network.
So here you've seen high definition video conferencing so compelling that one participant has forgotten that his counterpart is remote. So the Cisco telepresence system and others like them, HP Halo and others, offer high definition audio and video, lots of bandwidth, to try to create this illusion of being in the same room. Is this a breakthrough in immersive communication, or is this just a lot of high definition televisions and a lot of bandwidth? Well, in a sense, they're both, okay? So I contend that these are bridges to the future, and we're about to see rapid progress in this area over the next few years. So to put that into context, let's take a look at a brief history of television. Television was invented in its current form in 1926 as a counterpart to the telephone. So here you see one of the first televisions at AT&T Bell Labs. It's next to a telephone because the television is meant to communicate as the visual part of the telephone. So here is AT&T President Walter Gifford in New York at Bell Labs talking to Herbert Hoover, then Secretary of Commerce in Washington, D.C. in 1927. So the first long-distance television call. And shortly thereafter, the television became the broadcast medium that we know today, whereas video telephony took another 40 years to become the AT&T picture phone. And the picture phone was a stunning technical success, but also a stunning commercial failure. So by 1979, when I was an intern at Bell Labs, down the hall from me on the desk of my lab director, Bob Lucky, was the last remaining working picture phone in the world. Bob would often complain that nobody ever called him on it. Today, 40 years after that, the experience is actually very similar, except that now these little rectangular images are on general-purpose computers or on your phone now, but pretty much the experience is the same. They're small little rectangular images of video. Video conferencing, similarly, has been the same for the last 40 years in some senses. Here's the Bell Labs video conferencing system in 1967. You can see the round tables and multiple monitors, cameras on top of each monitor, the data monitor, which looks very similar to the recent telepresence systems today. So why do I contend that there's about to be a series of rapid breakthroughs in immersive communication when, for the last 80 years, not much has happened in visual communication? Well, there are several reasons. The first is the internet. Okay, so the internet has caused a divorce between the format of the content and the medium over which it is carried. So in the past, telephone calls were carried over telephone networks, television over television networks, radio over radio, and so forth. Today, all of those are carried over the internet. So there's a big possibility now of inventing arbitrary formats, and they'll all be carried over the internet. The second is, of course, the cost of computation, bandwidth, and resolution has been dropping exponentially for so long that they're essentially free now compared to what they were 20 years ago, say. And the third reason is that technology evolves faster than biology. Okay, so there will be a threshold at which the number of bits per second that we're able to capture, transmit, and render surpasses what we can actually pass through the neural cut set around our bodies. Okay, so at that point, we should have freedom to do whatever we like. And the question is, what do we want the future of human communication to look like at that point? Okay. So to the extent that Hollywood is the keeper of our collective dreams, you know, the answer that Hollywood would give is that they want communication to be immersive, whether it's like the holodeck in Star Trek or the Jedi Council meetings in Star Wars or the Matrix in The Matrix or in Avatar. Communication should be immersive. However, not all communication will be immersive. Okay, we will continue to send SMS messages, and the reasons are that there are some reasons, such as privacy, that we don't want to send everything about ourselves. So this was anticipated even by the Jetsons in 1962. So here's Jane Jetson putting on her vanity filter before she makes an early morning video call to her friend Gloria. Unfortunately, Gloria's own vanity filter has an embarrassing malfunction. And then there's one of my favorite cartoons. It's this from Pete Steiner in The New Yorker in 1993. On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Now, and that's still pretty much true today. There are reasons why we don't want to reveal everything about ourselves. And yet, for the more complex human interactions, the more creative things that we do with each other, we need more immersion. Because we're social animals. We have evolved to work with each other best face to face. So how we position ourselves relative to each other, you know, where we sit, how we gesture, our eye gaze, awareness of all of those things, they're all very important. And these have been studied by social psychologists and others, engineers, who build systems. For example, the work by Nguyen and Kenny in the Berkeley Multiview Project, they build a system that preserves eye gaze in teleconferencing, and they've shown that trust improves with correct eye gaze. So eye gaze has been a subject of video conferencing for a long time. There are many solutions, half mirrors, cameras behind the screens, view interpolation, and many others. Here's an example of view interpolation where there's an upper camera view and a lower camera view, and they can be interpolated to get better eye gaze. It's not only eye gaze that's important, it's reference and gesture. So here are some examples from the early 90s. Tung and Miniman showed at CHI 91 a system that had a shadow of the remote collaborator behind the collaboration surface. And a year later, Ishii had his famous clearboard where the actual video of the remote collaborator was projected onto the surface, the shared surface. Here's an example that's more recent, the HP Connect board, which is an update on Ishii's clearboard, in that perfect eye gaze is established by tracking the position of the observer's head as well as the eyes of the person in the video, so that the eyes on the video are always on the path between the observer and the camera, which is located behind the screen. But there are many other cues besides gaze and gesture, both auditory and visual, starting perhaps with peripheral awareness of what's going on in the room and consistency between the local space and the remote space. So if you look back at the telepresence systems today, you'll see that these preserve those first two characteristics. So peripheral awareness is provided by very large televisions. Okay, so we know what's going on in that remote room. Consistency between the local room and the remote room is preserved by making the desks look the same, painting the walls to be the same color in all the different rooms. So there's no difference between the back of one room and the back of another. So if you talk to the HP guys, they'll tell you that the Halo system, which was probably the first system in this category to come out, that was a collaboration between HP and the Hollywood studio DreamWorks, And, you know, Hollywood, as I said, you know, they know how to use illusion to suspend one's disbelief in actually being there. But there are many other immersive cues, spatial cues. For example, distance in audio is indicated by a combination of relative loudness, direct to reflected energy, and direct to reverberant energy ratios, as we can see in these clips.
On an average basis, growth in the 1970s doesn't look too bad.
So that one's presumably further away than this one.
On an average basis, growth in the 1970s doesn't look too bad.
Of course, he's probably adjusting the volume back there, so I'm not sure you can hear that. And of course, direction is given by intraoral temporal and intraoral intensity differences between your two ears. And on the visual side, there are many cues. I'll give you some examples of those. Relative size and perspective combine to give you a sense of distance and also absolute size. These are the same cues that are used in the famous Ames room illusion. Occlusion, lighting, and shadow are also very important for giving a sense of distance. In augmented reality, it's very important to be able to paint new objects into a scene such they occlude the background and yet do not occlude the foreground. Lighting and shadow are very important not only for realism but also for actual depth perception. So if you look at this picture of the footprints in the sand, lighting and shadow give you an impression of one footprint being impressed into the sand, the other one being above the sand. So by show of hands, how many of you perceive the top footprint to be the one that's impressed into the sand? Okay. And how many the bottom? Okay, maybe 1% think the bottom, 99% the top. Now keep your eyes fixed on that. Okay, don't blink, because if you blink, you'll probably change your mind. Okay, so even shadow has something to do with depth perception. Focus as well. So here's a very large city in China, but if we change the focus on the foreground and the background, it suddenly shrinks down to look something like a little model that might be next to your model train set. And of course, there are the very strong cues of stereoscopy and motion parallax. So some of you may be able to cross your eyes and fuse these images, and you'll get a very strong sense of depth. And I'll show you an example of motion parallax later on. But so are these cues important for communication? That's the question. And I contend that they are. Clearly, our current communication systems do not convey this information. And clearly, they are not satisfactory, or they're not, they can't fulfill every need for communication that we have. We continue to meet in person whenever we are able. We continue to travel to work. We continue to attend parties and weddings in person. We continue to come to meetings like this. You know, why don't we just email all our talks, our slides to each other, and just stay at home? Well, because there's something valuable about being here in person. And our current communication systems don't convey that. But I believe that the tools of signal processing will help us bridge that gap. So if you're a physicist, you might take a different approach. Okay, so physicists, I've read, have actually succeeded in transporting matter, a small molecule, over a significant distance. And this is how it would work if you were to use it for transporting, you know, somebody, say me, to a different part of the world. I would step into a matter transporter. I would be frozen down to absolute zero. I would be turned into a little brick of Bose-Einstein condensate. In the process of cooling down, I would emit light. The light would be transmitted to another place. It would shine on another little brick of Bose-Einstein condensate, and then my original state would be reproduced. Of course, if I don't completely cool down to zero, I may leave some state behind with unforeseen consequences. It's also sobering to think about what quantization and data compression would do on the way. You know, rate distortion optimized MPEG 4000. But at Microsoft Research, we're mostly computer scientists and signal processing people, so we take a different approach, which is we do the transportation of matter virtually rather than physically, and we achieve that through coordinate transformations. So if you imagine a person in a real space over here, he's got some coordinate system in his local space, and we just do a coordinate transformation of that over into some, you know, map that coordinate system into the coordinate system of some other space. And if we do that for several people, then we get them into the same area. So depending on whether the space that they're being transported into is virtual or real, it leads to two different approaches. I'll talk about both of these. You might sort of identify the first one with the movie The Matrix, if you're familiar with that. Everybody goes into a virtual world. The second approach could be identified with the movie Avatar, in which you send a physical representative of yourself into a real physical space. So I'll talk about each of these, starting with the first one. So the virtual, or the Matrix movie approach, can be applied to what we call fully distributed meetings. So we have people who are in completely separate places around the world. Maybe you and your colleagues are writing a paper together and you're sitting in your offices in different universities and you want to talk to each other, and the idea is to make it seem as if you're sitting around seated around the same table talking to each other. So the way we are doing that is by capturing geometry of each person, doing a coordinate transformation to put them all into a common scene. It's a life-sized scene. And then you give each person a window onto that scene. It's basically their display. And each person gets his own personal view of that scene. People interact through this in this way, preserving eye gaze, gesture direction, and so forth. So it doesn't matter whether the projection is onto a flat surface or onto a multiple monitor situation or maybe even a curved screen. So what we've done is build a wide field of view curved screen, and from a particular point of view, make it appear as if your local desk is extended into space. And then when we capture people's geometry using a depth camera that's situated on top of the screen, then we can position those people around in space as if they're having a meeting. So if you've never seen what images from a depth camera look like, this will give you a sense. Here's a still frame from a depth camera. You see, you can render a person from an arbitrary view. Okay, so basically that's what we do: capture geometry and texture of each participant, place them in this virtual world, and then let them collaborate. So here's an example of what you might see if you were attending one of these meetings. Your collaborator is sitting across the table from you. Maybe on the wall on the right, there's some artwork. It's glowing to reflect the mood of the conversation in the room. On the back wall, perhaps, is a large active computer display that can be used for the meeting. On the left wall here might be a window out onto the skyline of Singapore in this case, or wherever else you may want to hold your meeting. As other participants join the meeting, the people in the meeting can move around the table to make room. You know, people can bring in their own data. Other people may join the meeting and they come in from ordinary webcams or so they don't actually have their depth associated with them, but they can be represented as virtual displays here. Data such as what's showing in the center of the table here can float above the table and be manipulated and so forth. So these are some of the things you can do in this scenario. So that image, of course, was I didn't show. It was taken from one particular static point of view. But as people move around, the images move. So here's a video that shows this effect of motion parallax. So by tracking the position of the camera in this case, you can change what is presented on an ordinary display so that it appears as if there's some depth behind the display. So this is just using motion parallax to give that sense of depth. The same can be done with audio, actually. Okay, so you can do head tracking by, you know, visually, find out where a person's head is pointed, and then do a table lookup to find out the relationship between that person's head and a virtual source. Get the HRTFs for that and find out what's the signals that you want at each ear. Similarly, you know what the relationship of the head is to each of these loudspeakers, and then you can create a transfer matrix and invert it and do some crosstalk cancellation and produce at these loudspeakers signals that depend on where your head is at, so that the perceived location of the virtual source stays put. So it doesn't drift into one of the, doesn't collapse into one of the speakers as you move towards one of the speakers, for example. So we've done experiments on different form factors as well. This is an example of a wall where we've projected onto a holographic screen the same kind of thing you might see in a high-tech show, you know, a store window. And we try to make it appear through motion parallax and stereo parallax that the person is standing in the same room with you. So I want to take a 5-minute interlude here to talk about depth cameras, because depth cameras have had a recent breakthrough in cost and performance. So they're a new sensor that's really available very readily to everyone here, just like a webcam might be. So let me tell you about them. You might have heard about the Kinect for Xbox 360. It's a device like this that makes you, the game player, the controller. And when it was introduced in October last year, it sold 8 million units in the next 60 days, making it the fastest-selling consumer electronics device in history, earning it some position in the Guinness Book of World Records. That's enough of that. Basically, it's a depth camera. Okay, so at every pixel, it produces a depth or distance from the camera to something in the scene. So it enables you to quickly do some skeleton analysis, for example, of what the people are doing, enabling them to control the games. So under the covers, it's this kind of device. We have a regular RGB camera. We have an infrared camera that's pretty much just like the RGB camera, except that it has a filter in front of it, allowing it to see only infrared. There's an infrared projector that projects a known pattern onto the scene, and by correlating that known pattern with the observed infrared image, you get a disparity at each pixel and hence a depth. Also in this unit is a mic array designed by Ivan Tashev, who's possibly here. There's a motor, DSP unit, and USB port. So the motor tips the unit up and down. And all of this comes for $150. So it's not surprising that within 2 weeks after it was it was released, it was hacked into, and people hooked it up to their PCs and did all sorts of crazy things with it. There's a website here devoted to Kinect hacks, and by 1 month after release, there were about 90 projects on that site. In 3 months, there were 24 pages of projects. As of yesterday, there were 47 pages of projects. And these are all crazy things, like from robot navigation to seeing for the blind, to creating storefront windows that react to people wandering in front of them, and so forth and so on. So if you're interested in using this for some of your signal processing, I invite you to jump in. There is an open source driver, but it doesn't have any of the skeletal tracking or Yvonne's microarray processing. If you want that, you can wait a few weeks. I believe we'll be having a non-commercial SDK available for all of you to use free of charge. So I talked about how we were using depth cameras for immersive communication. Here's an application that's very closely related, and it will be actually released to Xbox Live Gold subscribers sometime this spring. So I thought I'd show that to you. It's called Avatar Kinect. Rather than showing you an advertisement, I've recorded my own video here. This is Corey. She's talking to me on her right and to Sasha on her left. Her image, the image of her avatar, is in this picture-in-picture thing.
Did I tell you about what happened last night? It was so cool.
You can see her avatar is tracking her emotions.
It was amazing.
So in addition to skeletal tracking of our arms, we have to do facial expression tracking. So you know who's when people are talking. You have to figure out where they're looking so you can animate their avatars and so forth. And you can imagine that, there are many other backgrounds you can use for this Avatar Kinect thing. So you can do a talk show, for example, with your friends, upload it to YouTube and so forth. So you can imagine that as the avatars get more and more sophisticated, eventually we may move into an era where immersive communication is something like a massive multiplayer video game, where you enter into this world, and your avatars are controlled by your actual emotions, your expressions, and your gestures. Okay, so let me return to the second approach. This is this real or so-called avatar-like avatar movie approach. Where you send a physical representative of yourself to a real space. So this works well for so-called hub and satellite meetings, where there are several people around in a real space, like a real conference room, and there are some remote attendees called satellites, and they send some proxy into the meeting. So we call these embodied social proxies. Here's an example of an early device. A regular LCD used for the face, fisheye cameras and pan tilt zoom cameras used for eyes, a speakerphone for mouth and ears. All of this is put on a cart. There's a computer, Wi-Fi, battery backup, and so forth. So they can attend meetings for you. And these are our current meetings. We have four of these carts in this particular room. One here, one here, one here, and one out of sight. We have collaborators around the world. John is in Silicon Valley. Andrew over here is in Cambridge, England. The meeting room itself is in Redmond, Washington, near Seattle. Some of these are on carts that have to be wheeled in. This one is actually robotic. It had walked through the door on its own. And the view from these carts of the room look like this, okay? So you get a wide field of view, peripheral awareness of what's in the room, and if you want to see some detail like what's on the screen, You click on the screen, the pan-tilt zoom camera goes over there and gives you a high-resolution version. So we use these not only for our own meetings, but we've done studies on them across real groups that are using them. So we deployed them in four different Microsoft product development teams where one of the members of the team was remote. And we deployed them for an eight-week period, conducted interviews and surveys at the beginning and at the end to determine whether people use these things. And by asking questions on the surveys that are based on a 7-point Likert scale, we determine meeting effectiveness, awareness, and social aspects by asking questions such as, I think X has a good sense of my reactions. Or for awareness, I'm aware of what X is currently working on and what is important to X. Or social aspects such as, I have a sense of closeness to X. And so by comparing the surveys at the beginning and at the end, we can determine, whether they've improved or not. And quite dramatically, we see a lot of improvement across all the four different groups that we put them into, and also different categories. These are verified by user comments. One user, for example, says that it actually succeeds in creating a workable illusion that the remote team member is in the room. It overcomes the barrier of his physical distance. And direct observation also showed that, in contrast to the audio conferencing that they had been using before, this now allows rapid turn-taking in conversation, following of what's going on the whiteboard and brainstorming, resolving issues at the meeting instead of waiting for the next time the person came to visit, saving some trips, and also assisting non-native English speakers to understand what's happening. And all of the proxies were named and given hats. And so they became part of the team. These are not new ideas. In the early 90s, Bill Buxton and Abby Sellin had their Hydra system. More recently, Paul Debevec introduced a really cool volumetric display. Henry Fuchs at UNC has been doing some work on animatronics. And there are telepresence robots, and they've even enabled a boy to attend school even though he has some immune deficiency. That was reported by CNN back in January. And IEEE Spectrum and the New York Times last September both had cover articles on these telepresence robots. User comments in both of those articles reveal pretty much the same things that we had already observed. So Eriko Gizzo from IEEE Spectrum says that, participating as a robot, you feel you get people's attention, and there's a better sense of being there. And Mike Belsner says you get the same kind of interpersonal connection that you'd have as if you were at the meeting. Interestingly, even in the one, in all those cases in the New York Times and Spectrum, the devices were given names and they were given hats. Still, there are many issues. Safety is one. I went down to visit AnyBots Robotics in Silicon Valley and found that they had one of their humanoid robots lashed to a wall after it had punched a big hole, which was still visible in the wall next to it. So there's some safety issues with robots. Wi-Fi coverage, what happens when robots walk out of range or run out of power? Can they keep up with people who are walking? How do they open doors or get on an elevator? You don't want people hacking into your robot and taking it over. And there are social issues like, do you want them to see better than humans, hear better than humans? What height should they be at? Is it socially acceptable to touch them and move them? So there are many issues, including how close should they come to looking human? And maybe you've seen in IEEE Spectrum some of Ishiguro's robots. These are quite fascinating. And they're not just wax models, they actually move. Let's see. And so this is a geminoid decay here is Professor Henrik Scharf at Aalborg University. And apparently, according to IEEE Spectrum, his wife says that she prefers body number one, but she suggests that we should always send body number two to conferences and stuff. So don't be surprised if at future ICASPs you see, you know, some robots wandering around. Okay. So far I've talked pretty much about two ends of a spectrum. In one approach we've had these virtual, you know, everybody transports into a virtual space, and in the other approach you transport into a real space through your proxies. In some sense the first is about virtual reality, which was promulgated by Jaron Lanier in the early 80s. It's about embedding people into the computer's world. The second one is about ubiquitous computing, promulgated by Mark Weiser in the late 80s. It's about embedding computational devices or computers into our world. And so there's really, these are really at two extremes, and I think what's really interesting is what could be in the middle. And the first time I became aware of that space was attending a talk at Stanford in the early 90s on VRML, virtual reality markup language. It had just been invented, and the inventors there were discussing the virtues of it and showing us how they had made a model of the entire university, and they were showing us how they could navigate their way through it. And so they wandered down the halls of the university and then came to a door of the conference room where we were sitting. And I expected that they would just kind of open the door, and inside we would see all of us sitting inside the room. And so I got a nervous feeling about, oh, maybe behind me, through the doors, will come some giant eyeball, and then there will be all these people behind it kind of looking at us. So I realized that there's this big gap between the virtual reality part and the physical reality. And so that's an area that I think needs a lot more exploration. I'll just say briefly that we've been doing some work in that area. We've called it parallel worlds at one point. It's about overlaying real and virtual worlds on top of each other and allowing people to sort of cross back and forth between one and the other. So how might people walk through a plaza, for example, or attend, you know, go to a museum? These are real places. How might they attend these remotely and experience them remotely, and also have the people in these real places experience the remote people as if they were there in the real space? So, you know, we'd have applications to attending weddings, for example, or trade shows and conferences, you know, going to poster sessions. How might you have a virtual person come to your poster and you could converse with that person as if they were there? So there are a lot of interesting signal processing issues. How do you instrument the space to capture the auditory part and the visual part so you can represent them remotely? And a more difficult thing is actually how you render remote people into a real space. So I want to conclude here. I've talked mostly from a technical point of view about immersive communication. Here I'll just talk about the societal need. So climate, energy, and environment are, you know, the big words of the day. I flew here from Seattle. It's 5,000 miles. I'll fly another 5,000 miles getting back. And the amount of CO2 I've released into the atmosphere is equivalent to all my local transportation. You know, I've done this, just for this week, I've used up my year's quota of local transportation. Probably all of you, you know, many of you have also flown from overseas. Collectively, I would say we've probably released into the atmosphere coming to this conference about 1,000 tons of CO2. So I don't think it's something we can afford really into the future. In terms of productivity, you know, I spent 3 days getting here for a 4-day meeting, so the ratio is not really good. But even on a day-to-day basis, in at least in the U.S., people spend close to 50 minutes per day on average commuting, which is perhaps about 10% of their work day. Information workers, though, spend about 56% of their time in communicating with other people. 60% of their time feel that they could do their job duties just as well at some remote location, for example, home. So there are things we can do about this. And Thomas Friedman said the world is flat, but it actually needs more flattening in today's economy. We need to bring people to jobs and jobs to people. And then there's physical security. You know, I guess the volcano in Iceland has started erupting again. But a year ago, a little over a year ago, for a period of 3 weeks, it caused the cancellation of 100,000 flights, stranded 8 million people across Europe. Many of you may have been among that group. And cost the airline industry 2.5 billion euros. So the economic damage is real. You remember ICAF 2003 was canceled because of SARS. So if there are viral outbreaks, it can shut down whole economies. Tsunamis and earthquakes, these things can also have a big effect. And terrorist threats, right? More traditional reasons for having telepresence and immersive communication have to do with bringing families closer together and then bringing healthcare and education around the world. So I'll just mention that, you know, many of these National Academy of Engineering grand challenges having to do with the global climate, as well as healthcare, security, these are all addressed by telepresence. So in conclusion, although visual communication has not really changed much in the last 80 years, the conditions are ripe due to convergence of affordable technologies and high social need for human communication to break through to new levels of immersion. And the signal processing community is in a unique position to be able to address the needed advances. So I think we should embrace the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Philip, for that exciting and informative talk. I definitely feel that we have still benefited from having you delivering the talk rather than your avatar.
How can you tell?
Anyway, we have an opportunity for some questions from the floor. So, we have one at the back. If you would go up to the mic, please.
How important do you think is the sense of touch, temperature, odor to immersive communications?
To touch and what else?
Temperature. Odor, and feeling kind of thing.
So, probably very important, but it's the least well understood. There's some articles in the immersive communication issue about haptics. I would say it's least well understood at this point. There's a lot of work to be done there.
So basically when I was at HP Labs asking the Hello guys looking at the demonstration, I asked them one question: what about the bandwidth? I mean, you need a lot of data to transfer and so on. And they were saying they are leasing special lines.
That's right.
So not everybody can lease a special line. So, I mean, how do you see that, like the transferring this amount of data, over the world. You don't transfer yourself physically, but still you transfer a large amount of data, and you need basically the bandwidth.
Well, the bandwidth capacity is going to vary over a very wide range. And so you can do various things to address lower bandwidth. So the Avatar Connect is an example where you're just controlling your parametric avatar and sending a series of parameters over the line. So it's much more like a game. And you still can get some amount of immersion in those situations. So I think the amount of realism will just depend on how much bandwidth you have available to you. And there are strategies for sort of going down to lower bandwidths. Is that sufficient? Yeah, well, how much bandwidth you need for different amounts of perception is an area for study, I would say.
Perhaps that one should be taken a little bit more offline. We have time for one last question.
With all these technology advances, what cannot be replaced by the human-to-human interactions? Would you be able to comment on that and share your insights?
So no matter what technology we use, there will be things that we just cannot replace with human-to-human communication. Is that what you're asking, basically? So, you know, I suppose touch is probably one of the good examples that's difficult to do right now. I really can't say into the future whether smell and other things, you know. I mean, I suppose eventually you just sort of jack into the matrix and put something in the back of your brain, and then, you replace everything. You become a brain in a vat at that point. What do you lose? You know, philosophers say we're already brains in a vat. Sorry, that's probably too glib for an answer.
Okay, we should thank Philip again and move to coffee. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Yes, I think touch is really important.